and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is also available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Board meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month, starting at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Afghanistan to India, a rubab sitar duet, on Saturday, April 7th at 7 p.m. at the Old Church Concert Hall in Portland. Join rubab master Humayun Saki for his first performance in Oregon and sitarist Josh Feinberg for short solo sets. Then they will play a set together in the second half of the concert. Refreshments and concessions will be served. Again, that's Afghanistan to India, a rubab sitar duet, on Saturday, April 7th at 7 p.m. at the Old Church Concert Hall, 1422 Southwest 11th Avenue in Portland. More information may be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. You are tuned to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM and streaming at kboo.fm. This is Lori Mercier, your host today for the Old Mole Variety Hour, where each Monday morning the collective of agitator moles provide interviews, reviews, and views from an underground perspective, which we hope lead to greater understanding, reflection, and action. Patsy Kohlberg is our engineer. The Old Mole burrows down to the roots of the great issues of our time, the struggles of ordinary people for democratic and sustainable ways of life. The Mole goes where corporate media fear to tread, supporting grassroots challenges to top-down authority and giving voice to movements that shake the foundations of an unjust society. As always, you can subscribe to the Old Mole podcast by going to our page on the KBOO website, and you can also find there links to past shows and segments, with further links to even more useful information, including how to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. And you can contact us through that page or at oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com. Leading off the hour, the Mole's Bill Resnick interviews Phyllis Bennis about U.S. entanglements with Saudi Arabia, Israel, and this very dangerous moment of Trump's accelerated threats against Iran. Author of 11 books, including the recent Understanding ISIS and the New Global War on Terror, Phyllis Bennis directs the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. Today, she explains what we can do to apply increased pressures on Congress to stop U.S. support for the war in Yemen and the humanitarian crisis there, and how all movements on the rise today must oppose U.S. militarism. Then Larry Bolden will review Renee Denfeld's novel, The Child Finder. Denfeld is famous for her nonfiction writing and her excellent debut novel, The Enchanted. The Mole's Jan Hocken will talk with Tim Buckley, one of the authors of the new Scarlet Letters, Sex Offenders, Their Treatment, and Our Challenge. They will discuss stereotypes and misconceptions of sex offenders and how the punitive orientation of the criminal justice system affects people who fall under this widening label. Finally, I speak with Connor Casey, labor archivist at the University of Washington, about the upcoming Pacific Northwest Labor History Conference in Seattle and how the Labor Archives attempts to preserve and share the region's laboring and activist past. From all of our guests, we learned today that this is a moment of great challenges and opportunities for resistance in the age of Trump. Now here is Bill Resnick and Phyllis Bennis.
Phyllis Bennis, welcome to KABU.
Great to be back with you.
Phyllis Bennis directs the New Internationalism Project at Institute for Policy Studies. She's a writer, an activist, an analyst on Middle East and UN issues. She speaks widely across the U.S. and around the world as part of the global peace movement. Her 11 books include Understanding the Palestinian-Israeli Conflict, also U.S. Foreign Policy and the War on Terror, and also Challenging Empire, How People, Governments, and the UN Defy U.S. Power. We certainly need that now. She continuously updates us with short pieces on the Institute for Policy Studies website and the New Internationalism newsletter. You can find both of them at the Institute for Policy Studies. Phyllis Bennis, you recently wrote about the under-the-radar gathering, a meeting with the United States, Saudi Arabia, Israel, and autocratic Gulf states. It was at the White House. It appears to have set the stage for a very aggressive U.S. campaign against Iran, including the use of military power, which will surely further inflame the region and draw in many, many other countries. It's likely to heat up soon with the U.S. pulling out of an international nuclear arms deal with Iran. It's a very complicated story with so many actors whose behavior is hard to predict, but alarming. So, Phyllis Bennis, what's happening? Why are the Trumpites targeting Iran now?
Well, the Trump administration is hardly the first U.S. administration to target Iran. Iran has been in the U.S. crosshairs for a couple of decades now. Iran is not, contrary to a lot of propaganda, an existential threat to Israel, certainly is not an existential threat to the United States. What Iran is a challenge to U.S. and U.S. proxies' efforts to be the regional dominant power in the Middle East. So there's a long-standing competition that's underway between Iran and Saudi Arabia for who's going to be the leading regional power. Militarily, of course, Israel is by far the most powerful component in the region, but it doesn't have the other components you need to be a regional. You need basically three things. You need size of land and population. You need wealth, usually from oil, and you need water. And historically, the only two countries in the Middle East that had all those three things were Iran and Iraq. The U.S. took Iraq out of the equation by 12 years of crippling sanctions and by its invasions and destruction and overthrow of the government. So then you had Iran emerging, and the new challenge initially came from Turkey for a brief period, but right now it's really Saudi Arabia that is the main challenger to Iran as the regional hegemon. And Iran's regional influence is far less military. There is military influence of Iran in a number of countries, but it's far more in the economic, trade, cultural arena. There's also, between Iran and Saudi Arabia, there's a long-standing sectarian battle as well. They represent two different strands of political versions of Islam. Saudi Arabia, of course, is run by very extremist versions of Sunni Islam, Iran by the Shia version of Islam. And that kind of sectarian divide between Sunni and Shia is a component. It's not the most important, it's not the strategic interests that have to do with trade and military power and access to water and all those things, but it is a factor in that competition. And you see that competition these days playing out with horrible consequences in places like Syria, where Iran and Saudi Arabia are waging war with Syrians doing the dying. You see it in Yemen with horrific consequences, where the long-running, decades-long civil conflict inside Yemen, which had never taken the form of a full-scale civil war, erupted into full-scale war on one side when Saudi Arabia decided to launch military assaults against Yemen in 2015, claiming that it was trying to reinstate the ousted former leader, but in fact doing it because the rebel forces known as the Houthis in Yemen, who had been fighting against the Yemeni government for a long, long time, were allied in some generic sense with Iran. They weren't very close to Iran. They weren't getting a lot of support from Iran. They were getting a little bit of support. But the Saudis decided that was unacceptable, and they went in on a massive bombing campaign, a huge effort to isolate Yemen and cut off its access to shipping so that a huge famine has erupted. 10,000 or more people have been killed in the bombing raids. And these are carried out by Saudi Arabia, the key U.S. Arab ally, with the direct and indirect support of the United States. So on the indirect side, of course, you have the Saudis buying tens of billions of dollars worth every year of the most advanced U.S. weapons. These are U.S. bombers, U.S. bombs that the Saudis are dropping on Yemeni civilians.
Yeah. I understand it's $5 billion a month costing the Saudis to buy all that equipment from the U.S. It's a bonanza for the U.S. arms industry.
It's a huge bonanza, and it's something that is very close to the Trump administration's heart. We should note that much of this, however, began under President Obama, who orchestrated a $60 billion arms deal with Saudi Arabia, what was then the largest arms deal in history. It's now been surpassed by newer arms deals. But the other thing that's important to recognize here is that it's not only the arms sales, it's direct involvement of the U.S. military. There are U.S. pilots flying U.S. Air Force planes along with the Saudi bombers, which of course were purchased from the U.S., who are doing the mid-air refueling so that they can be much more efficient in their bombing raids. So this is a U.S. direct responsibility for these.
They also, U.S. surveillance planes and drones and
Absolutely.
Satellites are also surveilling Yemen and finding targets. There aren't any targets. They're just killing civilians. Israel seems to me also part of that equation. My sense is it's like the Iraq War, where the leadership of the U.S., a sort of poorly qualified guys like Cheney and Rumsfeld with right-wing aspirations and glorying in war, like our cadet bone spurs, Trump, they really sink and win big battles. But the Israelis then fill them with propaganda that if only they get rid of this one power, it was Iraq back then, now it's Iran, then, in fact, they can take over the Middle East and it will become a sort of a paradise of free market capitalism and support for the U.S. as well as cheap oil.
The irony is that the Middle East today is, in fact, a bonanza for crony capitalism. You know, there's no socialist challenge to U.S.-dominated capitalism around the Middle East. The Israelis, I have a slightly different take. I think the Israelis were not the major force in pushing for war in Iraq. They wanted to go to war against Iran even back then. They jumped on the Iraq war bandwagon when it became clear that that was the first major target. Afghanistan didn't count in this sense. Iraq was going to be the first major regional target, and Israel certainly never saw the overthrow of an Arab regime that they didn't want to happen, so they jumped on that bandwagon. But they were not the main force pushing for war in Iraq. They wanted war directly against Iran then, and they want it now. And one of the key leaders of that period has just been appointed, as everybody knows, to be the new national security advisor, and that's John Bolton, who was one of the leading anti-Iran, bomb Iran voices, as well as a leading bomb Iraq voice back in the 1990s and into the period right after 9/11. He played a major role in orchestrating how the U.S. would go about initiating its war against Iraq. He was, for a brief time, when he was the, ironically, Undersecretary of State for Disarmament Affairs, one of his big claims to fame later was that he orchestrated the ouster of the chief of the Organization for the Prevention of Chemical Weapons, a noted Brazilian diplomat named José Bustani. And when he went to Bustani's office and said, "You've got 24 hours to resign." Why? Because Bustani was in the process of negotiating. This was in 2002, when tensions with Iraq were at their highest. U.S. war was looming, but there was still hope it could be somehow prevented. Bustani went to the Saddam Hussein regime and said, "You should join the Organization for the Prevention of Chemical Weapons. And the word was at that time that Saddam Hussein was prepared to do that. If he had done that, if he had signed on to join that organization, it would have required incredibly intrusive inspections across the country to certify Iraq's entrance to that organization. If that happened, it was clear in Washington that their false claims about Iraq supposedly having these so-called weapons of mass destruction, including chemical weapons, would be proved to be lies. They didn't want that to happen. So Bolton was given the task, or took the task, it's not clear, to get rid of the leadership of that organization to undermine that effort. He goes to Bustani and says, you've got 24 hours to resign. Bustani says, I will not. I've been reelected by the 145 nation states of this organization to be the director, and I'm keeping my job. And within just a few weeks, Bolton organized a vote and got enough votes through bribes and threats and punishments, the usual version of U.S. diplomacy, to vote him out. And so that was the end of the effort to have Iraq join the Organization for the Prevention of Chemical Weapons. So there's a long history that Bolton has directly, both in Iraq and Iran, and of course lately he's called directly for a first strike against North Korea. This is somebody who clearly disdains diplomacy and wants to move directly to war as the first response to any international crisis.
And he doesn't have to be even confirmed by the Senate.
Right, this is quite dangerous. It's not a confirmable position, so he just gets to start the day that Trump says he starts, which I think is April 9th. It's going to be a very, very dangerous, very frightening period because he's a man with no understanding of what war means in the countries where it's fought, no concern. He's not stupid, so I won't say he doesn't understand. I will say there's no evidence that he has any concern about what wars lead to, how wars spin out of control. You could say, well, Trump probably doesn't want to send ground troops, for instance, to Iran if there were to be an attack on Iran. That's probably true. But whether he gets to make that judgment call once the war has started and has escalated in ways that he could not predict is a whole different matter.
Yeah, their whole reputations. Once they begin the war, their whole lives become, and especially Trump, he doesn't want to be a loser. He will do anything. Lying is a small part of it, cheating, to be able to call himself a winner. It seems very, very dangerous, the character of these guys and the ignorance. This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Radio, talking to Phyllis Bennis of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. She does a lot of writing and speaking and activism within the peace movement and to try and stop the Israelis, Saudi Arabians, and U.S. efforts to dominate the Middle East. Phyllis Bennis, let's discuss what happens if Trump pulls out. There's every sign that he's going to pull out the deal with Iran and then starts making demands and threats and, who knows, provocations against Iran, which they may respond to. Tell us about what Iran could do. Tell us about what's happening in Europe and Russia and China.
Well, we don't know yet exactly what Trump is going to do on May 12th. That's the day that he has to certify whether or not to reimpose nuclear-related sanctions on Iran. That was the agreement the U.S. made when it signed the Iran nuclear deal, was to end the nuclear-related sanctions. The U.S., of course, is still imposing massive other sanctions on Iran. Those are continuing anyway. But the nuclear-related sanctions were to be lifted. The threat, of course, is that this time around, and Trump has indicated this, and certainly John Bolton would support the idea of ending that waiver and saying, nope, we're putting those nuclear sanctions back into play. At that point, Iran could say, well, that's fine, the U.S. is going to do what it's going to do. We are going to maintain our position implementing the terms of the agreement because we believe it's the right thing to do. That could certainly happen. On the other hand, there are hardline forces in Iran who may see this as an opportunity to shift that perspective and say, you see, because the U.S. can't be trusted, there's no way that we can maintain this agreement with the other five members that we signed with, those being European countries, Russia, and China. And we're going to go back to what we agreed to stop, which was enriching uranium for research and nuclear power, we're going to go back to enriching uranium. We're going to rebuild those machineries that we had either destroyed or put in storage to prevent us from continuing to enrich uranium. We're going to start doing that again. That, for the U.S., for some, they would say, well, that's evidence that Iran is now again trying to build a nuclear weapon, despite the fact that there was no nuclear weapons program, according to all 17 of the U.S. intelligence agencies back in 2003. So it's a very dangerous moment. If the Trump administration goes that route, it will open up a whole set of dangerous possibilities. The Europeans have not figured out a unified position yet of what they will do. The Trump administration has demanded that Europe take some new initiatives as the only way that they would agree to continue their role in the Iran nuclear deal. They've said that if Europe would demand changes to the deal and or add additional conditions, that they would agree to stay. But the problem is the deal is already a done deal. You can't go back and renegotiate it, reopen it, and assume that the Iranians are going to agree to these new, very stringent demands. So that's really not an option. The Israelis, of course, have been pushing. Netanyahu has made his political career over the last decade and a half or so at being the Israeli voice demanding of the U.S. that it not sign the nuclear deal, that it not implement the nuclear deal, and that now that it's in the nuclear deal, that it get rid of the nuclear deal. So that's been a longstanding Israeli position. Less visibly, but just as passionately, Saudi Arabia has taken that position as well. And the new crown prince of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman, known as MBS, who has become the BFF of Jared Kushner, the two of them, the crown princes, if you will, of Saudi Arabia and the United States, have put together what I believe to be a very dangerous kind of united front against Iran. All of this makes the May 12th deadline very, very critical. This leads to the question of what do we do about all this? I think what we do is keep the pressure on Congress. The White House may or may not be vulnerable at all to public pressure. There's no indication that it is. But Congress has to play a role here as well in terms of how it will take up the question of the Iran nuclear deal, what it will do in response. In the meantime, there are moves in Congress to stop the U.S. involvement in Yemen, to stop the U.S. support for the Saudi war against civilians in Yemen. There was a vote just this past week that came very, very tantalizingly close to winning. It was a vote that ultimately lost. 55 members voted to continue the war. 44 members of the Senate voted to move forward with a final decision that could lead to stopping U.S. support for the war. It was very close. And it indicates that the support for Saudi Arabia in the Senate, as well as in the House, is diminishing. So there needs to be continued pressure on Congress to stop the U.S. support for the war in Yemen. This is what the U.N. has called the worst humanitarian catastrophe going on in the world today.
Israel is very likely, though, to pull out all the stops to make sure that doesn't happen in Congress, it seems to me.
Well, Israel doesn't really have to on this one. Israel, I'm sure, supports the idea of continuing the war, but the Saudis have pulled out all their stops, and on this one they are far more visibly committed. This is really a Saudi initiative. This has everything to do with MBS's trip to the U.S. He's in the U.S. right now. He's going to be coming to California in the next couple of days. He's been up at MIT. He's been in New York. He's meeting with Silicon Valley. He's being feted in the pages of the New York Times as this great reformer. He's going to, wait for it, allow women to drive, despite the fact that women are still required to have a so-called guardian before they can apply for a passport, etc.
He's on a charm offensive in the West.
His main point is that he is leading a war against civilians in Yemen that has been responsible for the deaths of thousands. So that's the key thing about the Saudis right now. But there is a chance to stop this. There is no authorization. None of the earlier authorizations for the use of military force in any interpretation can be used to authorize the use of military force in Yemen. The authorization for force of 2001, which was designed to respond to the attacks of 9/11, was very specific. It was to be used against those who carried out the attacks of 9/11 and those who harbored them. That meant the Al-Qaeda, who carried them out, and the Taliban, who supported them. In Yemen, Al-Qaeda is gaining from the U.S. role. Al-Qaeda is on the same side as the Saudis in Yemen. So it simply doesn't work. There is no authority, and it's up to Congress to say the Constitution says only Congress can declare war. They are waging war illegally, and Congress needs to call them to account. There is the indication now that that could happen.
It seems to me that's a long shot, but in fact it becomes much more likely if the U.S. peace movement really revives, if the march coming up in Washington, D.C. and many other places to coincide with Trump's vainglorious, absurd war march. I believe it's on November 14th.
I think there will be protests against the parade. It's seen as a travesty, it's a waste of money, it's all those things, and there's lots of opposition to it. But beyond the marches, between now and then, this is a huge opportunity to bring the issues of the cost of war, how the fact that 54 cents out of every federal dollar goes to the military, and that's the biggest single reason why we don't have enough money for health care and education and jobs and infrastructure, more than anything else. That fact and the moral question, remembering Dr. Martin Luther King 50 years ago, reminding us that militarism is tied to poverty and racism and that you can't fight one without the other. It's not just about the peace movement coming back and going into the streets. It's about bringing the issues of war, the issues of militarism of our communities, how the militarization of police is tied to the militarization of U.S. foreign policy. All of these things are linked. Bringing those to the other movements that are on the rise so powerfully. This past weekend, when you had these incredible, inspiring protests all around the country, all around the world, 800-plus marches for our lives, marches against gun violence, not only mass shooters in schools, but the violence of police against young black people in communities across this country. When those police forces are armed with military weapons provided by the Pentagon, we need to be bringing to that movement, to the Black Lives Matter movement, to the immigrant rights movement, to the We Too movement, all of the movements that are rising today are tied to the question of militarism. And this is an incredible opportunity, using this issue of this insane parade idea, to bring that to these movements and do the kind of education that we haven't done enough of about what militarism looks like in this country and why it is dangerous for all of us here at home as well as internationally.
Phyllis Bennis, thanks a lot for talking. The next several months, we have time to really work intensively on this question, linking all of the movements. You said it so well. Thank you very much for talking to us today.
Thank you, Bill. It's been a pleasure.
All right. So long.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM and the Monday Old Mole Variety Hour. This is Laurie Mercier, and we just heard from Bill Resnick and Phyllis Bennis. Now Larry Bolden reviews Renee Denfeld's The Child Finder.
Good morning. Quote, "Of the children she had found, the ones who did best over the long term were the ones who found a way to play. They created fantasy worlds in which to hide. Some even talked their captors into giving them toys. Escaping into another world was a way for them to dissociate safely without losing touch with reality, unlike someone like Naomi, who had blanked it all out. Yes, the ones who did the best in the long run made a safe place inside their very own minds. Sometimes I even pretended to be someone else. Naomi didn't believe in resilience. She believed in imagination, close quote. So says the lead character and the investigator, child finder, in Renee Denfeld's superb novel, The Child Finder. Denfeld is a licensed investigator who specializes in death penalty work. Many of you readers will already know of her through her nonfiction writing or her excellent debut novel, The Enchanted, which I reviewed in 2014. Naomi, the child finder, has herself lived under captive conditions, and we readers are introduced to her as she looks for a girl, Madison, a girl who disappeared 3 years before when she was 5 years old. I have no intention of laying out much of the story here, since it is a finely woven mystery, and giving away much at all of the plot would be a sure spoiler. I will tell you that one of Madison's favorite folk tales is a Russian one of a snow child. Indeed, I just came across the folk tale this year in rereading and reviewing Ewan Ivey's lovely novel, The Snow Child. Madison decides that she, too, was rolled from the snow by her captor. Quote, "In this time of great awakening, the snow girl learned much about herself and the world. She learned the world was a lonely place because when she cried, no one came. She learned the world was an uncertain place because one moment you were one person and the next you were landed on your head all goofy and woke up in a dream. She learned the world was a wild place full of imagination because that was the only possible explanation for what had happened." Close quote. Ms. Denfeld skillfully takes us from the point of view of Naomi and her work to Madison's, and she's so deft in her weaving together of the two tales that the reader is kept on edge, but occasionally hopeful. Hopeful that Naomi will uncover more of her own blocked past via her search, and also that somehow, miraculously, Madison may be found. Besides great descriptions of the Pacific Northwest and the icy Cascades, Denfeld also shows her tremendous compassion for children, and through telling this tale makes evident her own great imagination. I found this book totally enchanting and actually read it in one long sitting, not something I do very often. It's very difficult to put down. On the jacket cover for the book, one commentator says, "Renee Denfeld has a gift for shining bright light in dark places." Indeed she does, and rather than risking being a spoiler, I'm going to stop now and urge you to pick up the book for yourself. It deserves all the praise it has gotten. I've been talking about Renee Denfeld's 2017 novel, The Child Finder. This is Larry Bolden for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Thanks, Larry. Now the Mole's Jan Hocken talks with Tim Buckley, one of the authors of the New Scarlet Letters, Sex Offenders, Their Treatment, and Our Challenge.
Welcome to KBOO and the Old Mole Variety Hour, Tim Buckley.
Thank you, Jan.
Well, Larry Bolden spoke about Renee Denfeld's book as shedding a light in dark places, and I think there's a kind of affinity with your project here as well, because most certainly this is one of the darker places of the criminal justice system. And indeed, in the foreword to the book, you and co-author Marilyn Callahan say sex offenders are perhaps the least understood segment of America's criminal justice system. As a result, they are subject to the most punitive sentencing laws. Well, in dispelling many of the myths and stereotypes about sex offenders, you and Marilyn Callahan bring considerable experience to this book project. Let's start with some of that experience and what led the two of you to write this book.
Well, thanks, Jan. Marilyn has been a licensed clinical social worker since the mid-1950s, and she, as a social worker, she came across incest almost immediately, and then realized that there was very little treatment, a lot of punishment for those caught and sentenced for sex crimes, but not very much treatment. So that's what drew her in that direction. I've been doing a lot of work in reentry in the Salem area since the early 90s, and I met Marilyn as I was a mentor to a young man who had just come out of prison with 4 years for sodomy. And so I was looking for a treatment provider, and Marilyn worked at that time, did a lot of pro bono work for people that were indigent.
And the book begins in the first chapter responding to the inevitable outcry from victims, although victim stories themselves are manipulated politically, and that's perhaps another point we may get to, but that you both make an effort to acknowledge the tremendous pain and suffering of victims of sex crimes before moving on and generating empathy for people who have committed sex crimes or accused of sex crimes. What was that part of the work like, addressing the suffering of victims of sex crimes versus victims of other crimes?
Well, it's a broad spectrum, as you know, that sometimes the perpetrators themselves have been victims earlier. And so we wanted to acknowledge that a book about about sex offenders also acknowledge that there are a lot of victims, both direct victims, those that are physically, their lives physically and emotionally have become torn up as a result of this action, but also secondary victims of sex offense. Those are the family members and even us in the community, because we have now a crisis or an epidemic of sex abuse in our culture.
And when you say an epidemic, can you say more about that?
Well, we live in a culture that glorifies sex, and at the same time, any crimes of a sexual nature are heavily punished. So you've got youngsters that are high schoolers or even younger who are dabbling in sexuality and find themselves too often felons at an early age as adolescents, some of them charged as adults. And that is part of the crisis we're in.
So there's a kind of combination of hysteria and denial around sexuality in general, which is both everywhere and nowhere, where kids are deprived of sex education in the schools other than your basics, and then when they turn to pornography, it's seen as a sign of extreme moral decay or corruption, and oh my God, what's happening to our youth? And of course, pornography is a theme of this term of the presidency.
Mm-hmm.
But what about the category of sex offender itself, and how what that encompasses? Because people often associate the term with pedophiles.
Yeah.
They get collapsed. But can you speak to that category and how it's broadened or changed over time in the criminal justice system?
That's a great question. It hasn't broadened and segmented enough, in my opinion. Sex offender in most people's minds still refers to the most serious of sex crimes. That would be serial rape and murder, pedophilia, you know, the almost the addiction for having sex with underage children. Because those crimes are so sensationalized, we tend to then think of everybody who comes out of the criminal justice system with a sex offender label as being that serious. So you
as use, being a monster.
As being a monster. And you use the term sex panic or sex, and it is. We're in a panic mode now because we want to put the lid on offending of children. And obviously, because most sex crimes are not even reported, we have just hit the tip of the iceberg, if you will.
Why do you think, even within the criminal justice system and prisoners I've spoken to, including at Oregon State Penitentiary where you work, often have the most contempt for sex offenders, I think, though probably a more differentiated set of distinctions and being directing contempt toward offenders of children? Oh, why do you think this is seen as the most horrific kind of offense?
Well, if you look at child molestation, it's the ultimate in deflowering or taking away the innocence of humans that don't have the capacity to choose themselves. And it's an
uncomplicated victim that we're dealing with here in terms of right. The child is representing innocence, lack of volitional power, decision-making mm-hmm. power, so that part of all of us that wants to claim that status as the uncorrupted victim gets perhaps carried into that identification.
Right, and then I would add to that, we live in a culture that tends to create an us and them scenario, right? So everybody, many of us love to have someone else that we look down upon, rather than seeing ourselves all as equals. And so even in the criminal world where you've got lifers that have murdered someone, taken someone's life, they can still find it in themselves that they're not as bad as a pedophile, for example. And I think in the classes that we all teach there, that there's an opportunity and a great success at getting people to look at that dichotomy and to come to a place of new understanding about me versus you.
So what have you found is the genuine picture of the range of outcomes of people who are charged with sex crimes? You've said there are stereotypes and assumptions that these are untreatable people who are unresponsive to interventions, that's a common stereotyped and misconception held by politicians and policymakers as well as the general public.
Yeah, and some treatment providers. You know, there's a line in the book that says one of the treatment providers that we talked to said the only cure for sex offense is a bullet to the head. Well, in Marilyn's case, in her 50 years of treatment, as well as these are also borne out with Department of Justice statistics, that 8 out of 10 or more of people who go through sex offender treatment have no more criminal activity whatsoever.
What about the sex offender registry system? Can you speak to that? Because that has been, of course, the response to the point you make in the book that most people who are in prison as sex offenders are ultimately 80% or so are ultimately released to their communities. So the response to this has been the registry system that is supposed to serve as, you know, a kind of warning system to the community. What about that system?
Well, I want to draw attention to a nonprofit called the Oregon Voices, and it's a good resource for people who want to know more about this. But it was one of the board members on that told me that the study of people on the registry is that less than 5% of people on the registry already commit another sex crime. So it suggests that 96% of all new crimes of sexual assault are created or perpetrated by people who are not on the registry. The registry also unfairly weighs on adolescents. So I think one of the things that we need to change in Oregon as a law is to make sure that those that are charged as juveniles do not then get bumped up to the adult system, because there's a very robust, comprehensive sex offender treatment program in the juvenile justice in Oregon, the Oregon Youth Authority, and it's highly regarded nationwide. So I think that's one area of the other part of the registry piece that is pretty onerous is that cities and municipalities have zones around parks and around schools and where kids are going to be frequenting. And sometimes those overlapping circles prevent anybody that's on the registry from living within that radius. And that often pushes people to an industrial zone or out onto the railroad tracks or down next to the river, where, in essence, there is no place for people to live. And when you do that, you exclude people out of society. And when you do that, you're asking for them to reoffend. When you don't include people back in and create a way to heal that wound, you're asking for people to act strangely.
And that speaks to the one of the main titles of the book, the New Scarlet Letters, that there's a shunning and a shaming that also seems to serve to uphold a sense of righteousness on the part of people who are out, inside the fold, in shunning those kept outside the fold. And that's another point you address in the book, is how sex offender circulates within political discourse as the others, the ones that shall not be forgiven, other than the politicians who seem to find ready forgiveness.
One of the things that Marilyn does with each client is at the beginning of their 18 months to 3 years of work together, is she says, the outcome I want for you is for you to become your own therapist. And I think that's good advice for everybody, because we all have thinking errors, we all make mistakes, we all have bias and judgment. And the treatment program that she works with people is to get them to understand their own innate qualities and to build on those strengths rather than the shaming piece. And I think
It means both recovering a sense of your own goodness and capacity as a person, but also confronting the disturbing and destructive aspects of yourself and what you've done.
Yes, absolutely. There's two parts to it. One is taking accountability, being responsible for the crime, the harm, the damage that you've done to your victim, but also then the support piece, which is how do we create a way for you to come back into the fold, back into the society in a way that is healthier.
And I think that's an example of where psychology and psychotherapy bump up against the constraints of the political world too, that you can become your own therapist and work with these issues, but if you're still cast out of the realm of normalcy, you're kind of pushed back into old scripts. And so how do you and Marilyn, who work on the psychotherapeutic front, confront the political barriers?
Well, that's a great question, Jan. Marilyn was perhaps unusual in the world of treatment providers. She went outside of the traditional role of therapist and became an advocate and a champion for her clients. That meant sometimes going to the legislature to get laws changed, which she did. It meant working with the parole and probation officers to make sure that they were on the same page. It also meant working with community organizations like Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon, which in the last few years did a pilot project called Circles of Support and Accountability. And that is...
Is it related to restorative justice in a sense?
It's very much a restorative justice model. So it broadens the pool instead of it just being the court and the cops against the offender. It broadens the conversation and the involvement of the community in making sure that the person is held accountable as well as given an opportunity to come back into right relationship with the rest of the community, including the victim.
And I think this speaks to the subtitle of the book, which is Sex Offenders, Their Treatment, and Our Challenge. And so you try to bring the problem from the they and them or the other into the fold of the rest of us. And just in closing, what about that challenge and how you see a book like the one you and Marilyn have co-authored as contributing to that?
Well, the book is not academic, so it's meant for parents to read and to bring the shame of incest out of the closet. It's for treatment providers to use. It's for correctional people. It's for reentry people. And I'm really pleased to see that the churches have come forward in the last decade to show up and try to fill gaps in our culture that have been left empty by the lack of leadership in the political realm.
Or the punitiveness.
Yes.
I want to congratulate both of you on such a brave project as well as an informative one. This is Jan Hawkins talking today with Tim Buckley, co-author, along with Marilyn Callahan of S.O., The New Scarlet Letters, and subtitle Sex Offenders, Their Treatment, and Our Challenge. Thanks so much for being with us today.
You're welcome. And the book is available on Amazon.
Okay, and we'll be on our podcast link sometime in the next few days. Encourage people to read it and get back to you on their experiences with the book.
Great. Thank you very much, Jan.
Thank you, Jan Hawken and Tim Buckley. On the line with me is Connor Casey, labor archivist of the Labor Archives of the University of Washington Libraries and co-chair of the upcoming Pacific Northwest Labor History Association's 50th anniversary meeting next week, April 6th through 8th, at the Hilton Seattle Airport and Conference Center in SeaTac, Washington. Connor, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you very much. Good morning.
Good morning. So tell us something about the Pacific Northwest Labor History Association.
Well, I think we're really lucky in the Northwest in that we have a labor history association that was intentionally formed as sort of an amalgamation between academic historians and labor union activists and people who are interested in labor history. So it's sort of an interesting hybrid organization in that there's both academic foci, but also an inclusion of the people that are already doing labor history, which are, you know, folks that are in the labor movement, rank and file unionists, people on union history committees, as well as students and people that are teaching like K through 12.
And it's so great at these meetings to see how union activists and other activists really embrace history as a tool for improving their activism and organizing. And Norm Diamond, who's a member of the Pacific Northwest Labor History Association, has been on our show, the Old Mole Variety Hour, a number of times, talking about some of his projects in educating union activists. So what are some of the sessions and speakers? I'm thinking on Saturday, April 7th, for Northwest Oregonians and Southwest Washington folks who might be able to get up to SeaTac for this event. What are some of the highlights, including some of the featured speakers?
Well, that's a good question. Actually, I have a pretty good memory of this because I've been putting together the program, so I appreciate the question. There's going to be one session that's specifically on tracing a thread between African-American activism and the Black Freedom Movement from Tyree Scott, who was an organizer with the United Construction Workers around here in Seattle, all the way through Black Lives Matter by former Black Panther and City of Seattle leader Gary Owens. There'll also be these really great plenary addresses. One is by Bill Fletcher Jr., who's a civil rights activist and labor activist. He really looks at sort of some of the challenges and the ways in which the labor movement can improve in relation to race, as well as what we do, you know, now that the labor movement has been sort of challenged within the last 30 or 40 years, especially as we're facing down the potential Janus ruling.
And Bill Fletcher was just recently in Portland, but I think it was an icy evening, so many folks may not have been able to hear him. So this is a great opportunity for people in Portland to get up to SeaTac to hear Bill Fletcher.
A rousing speaker, and he's actually part of an existing initiative by the Washington State Labor Council, sort of a race and equity initiative that I believe Kent Wong is involved with too, and it's sort of trainings that are meant for people in the labor movement relating to race, and that's another keynote, which is Kent Wong, who is the director of the UCLA Labor Center, and has been involved in a lot of you know, LA has not been traditionally known as a labor town, but within the last 20 years, 20 or 30 years, that narrative has been completely inverted because of the union movement's willingness to involve younger leaders, workers of color, and immigrant communities in a way that has completely shifted some of the power structures in Los Angeles. And it sort of points the way to building a strong labor town that incorporates instead of leaves out immigrant communities. You know, some of the other ones that we have are really interesting. Yeah, as you know, folks in Oregon, Southwest Oregon, are probably familiar with the Longshore Union, the ILWU, which has impacts on the labor history and the culture up and down the Pacific Coast. There's going to be this really interesting session by ILWU Local 500 sister, Jolene Parent, who's going to be talking about indigenous workers on the waterfront up in the Vancouver area. There'll also be a discussion of a collection that is at University of Oregon about the quote-unquote missing ILWU archives, the ones that were taken away when Harry Bridges kind of created his West Coast insurgency by the existing ILA leadership. So that should be kind of interesting. There's going to be a workshop by an artist about the 99 WTO protests and the illustrations that he did for that. And then, of course, as you mentioned, that great Norm Diamond one, which is how do you teach labor history to people that already are labor organizers, right? It's a different project than people who don't know anything about labor history. So he's doing, as you know, this great web series or televised recorded series of trainings for labor leaders, and they're going to broadcast it through Jobs with Justice as an ongoing training resource.
It all sounds great, Connor. So tell folks how they can find out more information about this conference coming up next week, April 6th through the 8th.
Oh, sure. I'd invite them to check out our website, www.pnlha.org, for Pacific Northwest Labor History Association. We have a sort of proto-program there. Soon I'll be adding the full program, the completed one, to the website. And, you know, you can register there and also find out more information online there.
And let's just quickly talk about the labor archives at UW. You've been involved in collecting Washington State labor history for some years. Why is this collecting and preservation of labor's past important, not just for scholars, but for activists today?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, there's sort of that that quote about, you know, those who, you know, forget history or condemned to repeat it. But I think that the other thing that's great about it is that we're actually a resource that unions can use, and that we collect their records so that they can gain access to the things that they need for their active administrative business. So it may be that they give us their records of what we call it enduring historic value, the stuff that they're not using every day, but they know is important. And that's the kind of stuff we collect. We were formed in 2010 by the labor community. For the first 3 or 4 years, we were completely crowdfunded by the labor movement until we got state funding. And we're really here both as a resource for the academics and students to be able to get access to these records so that they can do research, but we're also here to help collect, preserve, and make accessible labor union records for the labor movement. And so we also do consultations and workshops on records management and what to expect when they donate collections. That's kind of the value that we add to it, and I think that you know, control and access, as anybody who's been in a union office who has the task of trying to figure out, well, geez, where was that contract, or, you know, what were we saying in those negotiations, or is there correspondence from that president? There's a archivist I worked with down in San Francisco State's Labor Archives that told me 3 moves equals 1 fire in labor archives, and that's the crisis that we faced in 2008 that gave rise to the formation of the labor archives in 2010 was that, as everyone knows, where you put archives is usually the boiler room or the attic.
Yes.
The worst places that you can put them.
And you've been involved in some great collecting activities too, such as the SeaTac Seattle Minimum Wage History Project and all of these projects that really help us understand what strategies and tactics work and what might not work so well as we move these movements forward. Thanks so much for joining us, Connor Casey, and we encourage people to check out the program for the Pacific Northwest Labor History Association's 50th anniversary meeting next week. And we've got to close the show today. Thank you, Connor. And that's it for the Old Mole Variety Hour on March 26. We heard music today from Catherine Feeney of Portland, and thoughtful commentaries and news from Bill Resnick, Phyllis Bennis, Tim Buckley, Jan Hocken, Larry Bolden, and Connor Casey. You can listen to the show again via podcast on kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. And stay tuned to KBOO to hear at 10 o'clock on Locus Focus, Barbara Bernstein talks to Columbia Riverkeepers Conservation Director about the Thin Green Line, holding firm against the onslaught of fossil fuel development in the Northwest. At 11, it's Making Contact with Patisse Khan Cullors, co-founder of Black Lives Matter and the author of the new book, When They Call You a Terrorist. At 11:30, Voices for the Animals interviews Debbie Ethel from the COTA Foundation, who will be speaking at the Free the Elephants Conference in Portland. We want to thank Patsy Kohlberg today, again, for her expert engineering. And thank you, KBOO members, for your support. To keep informed and get involved, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member.
This is Ursula K. Le Guin, and you are listening to KBOO, the cheerful voice of social conscience, KBOO, Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of He Moves Like the Ocean, a performance, on Monday, March 26th at 7:30 p.m. at Performance Works Northwest in Portland. In this performance, adults take on movements of a child. Three pairs of dancers and musicians will learn and score short clips of the child's movement and then improvise in his style. Again, that's He Moves Like the Ocean, a performance, on Monday, March 26th at 7:30 p.m. at Performance Works.